This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Iran nuclear talks miss another deadline. Greece and its European partners agree on bailout terms. New evidence shows why some people don't seem to get old.
This is prime of life, peak health. You're not going to see any change. So we did see change, and that was surprising. The second surprise was how much variation in that change there was in the population.
One of rock music's legendary groups play their closing chord. We'll give it a listen. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Several diplomatic delegations are anticipating an announcement for mid-morning in the Iran nuclear talks, hours after the deadline on the latest round of negotiations expired. Meetings between the P5 plus one countries and Iran continued overnight Monday as negotiators in Vienna scrambled to finalize a deal years in the making. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said genuine progress had been made, although several issues remained under review. He also said that negotiators would remain at the table as long as discussions between Iran and the six other countries were productive. A State Department spokesman told VOA late Monday negotiators were close to a deal, although sticking points remained. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry continued meetings with his counterparts well into the night. RAND senior policy analyst Ali Reza Nadir spoke with International Edition's Jeffrey Young about what an Iran nuclear agreement could provide for both sides.
If the final nuclear agreement is based on the framework agreement that was released in April, then it could be a very solid agreement. For the first time in 12 years, Iran and the P5 plus one, the UN Security Council plus Germany, will have come to an agreement in terms of what Iran will be able to do regarding its nuclear program. Potentially, this agreement will prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapons capability, but also allow Iran to pursue peaceful nuclear activities. And overall, this could be good for global security and regional stability in the Middle East. It could really release or decrease tensions between the United States and Iran that have built over the last 10 years.
There are reports, and you've seen them too, that some people claim this agreement may trigger a huge arms race in the Middle East because Sunni nations may want to arm themselves. What's your reaction to that sort of mindset?
If we're talking about nuclear arms, this is unlikely, as the costs of producing or creating a nuclear weapons program are very high in terms of the economic, political, and geopolitical costs. For example, if a country X wanted to emulate Iran, then it would be deterred by the cost Iran has borne because of sanctions and isolation. And a lot of the countries in the Middle East are allied with the United States, and essentially they would either have to jeopardize their alliance or go ahead and produce nuclear weapons. In terms of conventional arms, there's already an arms race in the Middle East regardless. So the nuclear agreement in itself isn't likely to lead to nuclear proliferation. It could increase tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia in the short term, however.
There has been much discussion about the amount of higher enriched uranium. I didn't say highly, but higher. The 20% enrichment that was done ostensibly for the Tehran Research Reactor. Now, there are people looking at that stockpile of 20% and saying, we've got to get it out of there. We can't let them have it. They can't be allowed to enrich it higher than that, possibly to weapons grade. What would you do with this stockpile of 20%? Should it exit the country? Should it be put under IAEA control? What's the answer?
One possibility is for Iran to send it to Russia for further processing, and that's been in discussion for years, and Iran may be amenable to that, and that could be part of a final nuclear deal.
That was RAND senior policy analyst Ali Reza Nadir speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. After 17 hours of negotiations in Brussels, Eurozone leaders reached a deal that would see Greece enact difficult reforms in return for a massive new bailout. But the agreement struck Monday is just the first step. Lisa Bryant has details.
The agreement reached by Greece and the other 18 Eurozone members is by no means a done deal. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras must now get his country's parliament to approve tough new austerity measures by Wednesday. He must also sell them to a Greek public who rejected less stringent bailout terms in a referendum just a week ago. Several Eurozone members, including Germany, one of the biggest skeptics of a new deal, must also seek parliamentary approval just to start negotiations on a new assistance package for Athens. But leaders, starting with European Union President Donald Tusk, hailed the accord.
The decision gives Greece a chance to get back on track with the support of European partners. It also avoids the social, economic and political consequences that a negative outcome would have brought.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel said that after the Greek parliament approved the conditions, she would recommend in full confidence that German lawmakers approve the deal.
Sie wirklich dann in die Praxis umgesetzt werden. Ich glaube, dass Griechenland Chancen hat.
Ms. Merkel said there was a broad array of supports which, if implemented, would pave the way for Greece to return to growth. But it would be a long and difficult path. Prime Minister Tsipras faces some difficult days ahead as he seeks approval at home. The new austerity demands come in return for a new three-year, $95 billion bailout agreement for Athens. Mr. Tsipras said his team had fought a difficult battle, but he had to make some tough decisions to avoid a harsher outcome. Without an agreement, Greece risked bankruptcy and a possible exit from the Eurozone. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
VOA business reporter Alexis Christophorus in New York spoke with International Edition's Michael Lippin about the bailout for Greece and other financial news.
At least for a couple of days, U.S. investors have a reprieve from the Greek drama with this new deal that has been struck between Greece and its creditors. It still has a long way to go, we know, but if it's approved, it would be Greece's third bailout in 5 years and would avoid Greece exiting the Eurozone. Major markets in Europe rallied on the news. Germany's DAX climbed 1.5%, France's CAC 40 surged nearly 2%, and Britain's FTSE 100 finished with a gain of 1%. And we saw Chinese stocks lead Asian markets higher on news that China's exports rose for the first time in 4 months. Now U.S. investors are turning their attention to second quarter earnings. They begin to pick up this week with reports from J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Intel. Earnings in the S&P 500, though, are forecast to slip 4.5%, and that would be the first drop in quarterly earnings in nearly 3 years. Now, there were some movers and shakers. Microsoft said it would roll out Windows 10 in late July. The upgrading operating system is supposed to allow users to switch seamlessly between personal computers and their gadgets. Microsoft gained 2% and was the biggest gainer in the Dow. And Netflix's previously announced 7-for-1 stock split takes effect Tuesday. The company is out with earnings on Wednesday. Goldman Sachs boosted its price target on Netflix. And in case you're keeping track, Netflix's stock has more than doubled so far this year. It's closing in on $710 a share, Michael.
Okay, well, just a quick look at the oil markets now. I understand the OPEC oil cartel is predicting that demand for oil is going to rise internationally, but that didn't help oil prices. Why is that?
That's right. Oil prices slumped about 2%. There's still a lot of uncertainty around a nuclear deal and whether that can be reached with Iran. OPEC did say it sees stronger demand in 2016. The oil cartel says momentum in the global economy, especially in the emerging markets, will contribute further to oil demand growth in the coming year.
VOA's Alexis Christophorus in New York speaking with International Edition's Michael Lippin. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The 2016 race for U.S. president continues to move along at a rapid pace. Another Republican Party candidate officially announced his entry Monday. VOA's Jim Malone talked with International Edition Susan Yockey about the latest developments and what Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton had to say about her own economic plan for Americans during a speech in New York.
In a nutshell, she wants to talk about boosting economic growth for all Americans, particularly with an eye toward helping middle-class Americans. This has been one of the real themes in recent years in the United States, the declining power of the middle class, declining wages. People want to find ways to improve their lot in our society and in the economy, and Clinton's trying to find ways to do that by boosting the middle class. We should point out, though, that this comes in the wake of an increased challenge from one of her rivals, Bernie Sanders, who's a self-described socialist, who actually has talked about redistributing wealth in the United States. So it looks like Bernie Sanders may be pushing Hillary Clinton a little bit more to the left, though Clinton remains in a strong position in the Democratic primaries.
Well, where does Clinton stand in the polls? Is she still way out in front like she
was? She's out in front, but, you know, Bernie Sanders has been catching up a little bit, particularly in some of these early contest states we like to talk about, Iowa and New Hampshire. She's ahead. But Sanders is narrowing the gap. He's one of four Democratic challengers and by far getting the most notice at the moment. This will go on for a while. Most of the analysts I talk to think Clinton is still a strong favorite.
Well, meanwhile, the Republican field of candidates running for the White House has increased to 15. It's hard to keep track of them all. I mean, 15 of them. The latest one to throw in his hat in the ring is Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. What do we know about this guy?
Well, you know, he's had an interesting career so far. He won two elections as governor in Wisconsin, actually three if you count a recall effort that was mounted by union supporters when he decided to take on the unions in Wisconsin to try to trim their collective bargaining rights. So that actually helped Walker around the country with conservatives. He's considered a strong challenger here. Generally, the top tier of the 15 includes people like Jeb Bush, the former Florida governor, Senator Marco Rubio, Florida, and Walker. Walker also is leading in the early polls in Iowa, which is a neighboring state. He spent some time there growing up. So he's seen as one of the favorites, but also probably with a lot to prove, especially on foreign policy, I would say.
VOA national correspondent Jim Malone talking to International Edition Susan Yockey. Governor Scott Walker and the other Republican contenders have been overshadowed of late by New York business tycoon Donald Trump, who recently took his anti-illegal immigration message to the border state of Arizona.
I respect Mexico greatly as a country, but the problem we have is that their leaders are much smarter, sharper, and more cunning than our leaders, and they're killing us at the border. And they're killing us in trade. They're killing us.
Donald Trump continues to draw attention and criticism for her sharp anti-illegal immigrant message. Recent national polls show him in second place behind former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. Time now to hear what social media is saying about the latest Republican presidential hopeful, Scott Walker. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here in the studio. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray. As we heard earlier, the latest person to join the already crowded race is Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who is on Twitter at Scott Walker. We're talking about the upcoming U.S. presidential election in 2016. He tweeted, "I am in. I'm running for president because Americans deserve a leader who will fight and win for them." That's been retweeted almost 1,800 times and marked as a favorite nearly 1,600 times. He included hashtag Walker16 in the tweet.
And about how many people are using that hashtag?
The social media analytics website Topsy shows that it's been used in almost 6,500 tweets in the last 24 hours.
So would you say, by looking at all the material, that he's getting a lot of attention on social media compared to his competitors?
Not necessarily. It's certainly not the most dynamic response ever from the public. For instance, when the leading Democratic candidate, Hillary Clinton, announced her candidacy back in April, her tweet has been retweeted nearly 104,000 times and marked as a favorite even more at around 107,000 times. That's a difference of more than 102,000 tweets between Walker and Clinton. The former Secretary of State wrote, "I'm running for president. Everyday Americans need a champion, and I want to be that champion." But we have to keep in mind that Hillary Clinton and her husband Bill Clinton are both household names in America.
Well, that certainly is a significant difference for sure. What about compared to the other Republican contenders?
Well, let me give you an example. When former Florida Governor Jeb Bush announced his candidacy on Twitter last month, that tweet was shared more than 1,700 times and marked as a favorite nearly 1,500 times. So not that much different from the response Walker got today.
We have a long, long way to go yet till next year's election, so I'm sure a lot will be changing during that time. Thanks for the wrap-up, G. Social media reporter G. Abby Lee. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. Still to come, some legendary rock music stars say goodbye. This is VOA.
This is Green Beat for a healthier planet.
In the search for greener energy, enterprising researchers have come up with some creative alternatives to fossil fuels. Cow manure, for one.
We have turned 75 tons of cow dung into fuel that can be used in two blast furnaces for around 6 hours.
That's Byung-chul Kim, head of research and development at South Korea's Hyundai Steel, where the manure is used as an auxiliary to coal in steel production. In the Czech Republic, leftover sludge from leather production provides the means for new biodiesel. Professor Karol Kolomaznik leads the research team at Tomas Bata University.
The principle is to remove glycerin from the fat, replace the glycerin by the simple methyl alcohol, and then proceed to separate glycerin from diesel.
According to the researchers, the technology could be used to produce fuel from any type of plant or animal fat. I'm VOA's Rebecca Ward for Green Beat.
This is VOA's International Edition coming to you from Washington. If you're feeling kind of old, in fact, older than you think you should, there may be a good reason for that. A new study finds that people grow old at different rates. In some cases, it's significantly older than their chronological age. VOA's Jessica Berman explains.
An international team says there may be a reason why some people seem to stay young well into their dotage. Researchers from the U.S., Britain, Israel, and New Zealand observed that at the physical age of 38, the biological age of individuals was all over the map. Some 38-year-old bodies were still in their 20s, while others were nearly 60. Dan Belsky is a professor of geriatrics at Duke Center for Aging and a study author. Belsky says the findings that people decline faster or slower physically beginning at a relatively young age go counter to what is commonly believed.
This is prime of life, peak health. You're not going to see any change. So we did see change, and that was surprising. The second surprise was how much variation in that change there was in the population. People really did age very slowly and also very rapidly.
Investigators analyzed data from the Dunedin study, a long-term health study in New Zealand, seeking clues to factors involved in aging. 18 biomarkers, including blood vessel integrity, kidney and liver functions, measurements of metabolism and immunity, were measured in a group of 1,000 people beginning at age 26. The health biomarkers were taken again when the participants were age 32 and again at 38. A calculation based on the readings was developed to determine each volunteer's pace of aging. Then Belsky says tests usually reserved for older individuals were given to the participants.
So we tested their balance, we tested their strength, we tested their motor coordination. We interviewed them about physical limitations they might have, having trouble climbing stairs, carrying groceries, walking a mile. And we also gave them some cognitive tests. And what we saw was that the study members we had measured to be aging faster were having more physical problems. They were weaker. They had poor balance. They were not as coordinated. And they were more likely to report physical limitations. And they're still 38 years old and mostly free of any kind of chronic disease.
Then researchers conducted what was in some ways the ultimate litmus test of aging. They asked college students to look at pictures of the participants.
And they rated those faces as looking young or looking old. And the very same study members we had measured to be aging very rapidly were also rated by these Duke undergraduates as looking older.
The findings were published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. By studying the rate of aging, investigators hope they can get a jump on some age-related diseases earlier in a person's life. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
And speaking of old, how about those American rockers, the Grateful Dead? For millions of fans, that group, which started in the 1960s, were not only musicians, but also definers of culture and lifestyle. Recently, the band played its last three shows ever at Chicago's Soldier Field. International Edition's David Byrd sat down with Ray McDonald to talk about it.
Ray, this was really something. These were 3 days in a row and three shows in a row and three sellouts, right?
Three sold-out shows at Soldier Field in Chicago. And it was no accident the Dead played their final shows there because it was at Soldier Field in July 1995 when guitarist Jerry Garcia gave his final concert. He died 1 month later.
Now, these shows featured some of their greatest hits. It featured some of their songs that people might not have heard in a while, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Dead really went back to their early psychedelic days for a few of their numbers. I mean, this was the Dead playing for its core constituency, the longtime Deadheads, the people who had been with them maybe right from the very beginning in the 1960s. So they got pretty adventurous, and then they played some of their better-known hits as well.
Chuckin'. Got my chips cashed in, keep trucking like the two-dog man together, more or less in line, just keep trucking.
Now, the thing about the people called the Deadheads, they will have bootlegs of concerts that they've been to. Sometimes they're very devoted followers. They go from show to show to show to show to show. But that's all come to an end now.
Supposedly it's come to an end. And one thing I should say about the Deadheads is that decades before the internet existed, these people were trading information about the band. The Grateful Dead was really the first act, first big rock act I can think of, to create its own culture. And these people would travel around the country to be with them. Now, as to whether these were the final shows, that's an open question. When all is said and done, these shows may rack up more than $55 million. They set an online live event streaming record with more than 175,000 pay-per-view streams purchased. Their drummer, Bill Kreutzmann, has already said that he would like to do some East Coast shows with the so-called Core Four members. So it might be their last, and then again, it might not. The average age of the Core Four is 70. That may be working against them.
That could work against them. Of course, the Rolling Stones and the Eagles and the Doobie Brothers.
Paul McCartney, you can name exceptions.
They're all of that same generation, pretty much, and they are doing tours now. So, and the Stones, I understand, are selling out. So,
oh, yeah.
All right, that's VOA's Ray McDonald. You know, if you have any questions or comments, you can send a tweet to VOA_music. That'll get to all of our music folks. And you can send one to VOA_IE if you want to direct it to me or anybody here on the show. Also, you can listen for Ray to count down the top 20 songs of the week and the top 5 songs of the week by logging on to our website. That's www.voanews.com.
Must be getting early.
it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information, pictures and videos. If you don't feel like reading, it's all on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This year marks the 20th anniversary of the normalization of relations between the United States and Vietnam. In recognition of the progress achieved in U.S.-Vietnam relations, President Barack Obama recently welcomed General Secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of Vietnam, Nguyen Phu Trong, to the White House. Over the past two decades, we've made tremendous strides in our bilateral relationship, as General Secretary Trong's visit so clearly demonstrated. Bilateral trade has grown 80-fold to more than $36 billion. U.S. investment in Vietnam now tops $1.3 billion. And there is more than $1 billion in Vietnamese investment every year in the United States, helping to support American jobs. Our two countries, in close coordination with other partners, are working to conclude the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which could potentially create significant job growth and prosperity for both the Vietnamese and the American people, and further expand our growing economic ties. We've also made significant progress in deepening cooperation in a wide range of areas, including education, science and technology, climate change, public health, and security issues. And we're committed to further strengthening cooperation on regional and global issues of mutual interest. We share concern about recent developments in the South China Sea and recognize the imperative of upholding the international rules and norms, including freedom of navigation, that have underwritten the region's dramatic economic growth. These achievements have been possible thanks to the constructive effort of leaders in both countries to rise above the past, overcome differences, and promote shared interests with an eye to the future. Of course, as President Obama noted, there remain differences in the bilateral relationship, including over issues of human rights and freedom of religion. But through the diplomatic dialogue and practical steps being taken by both countries, we trust these tensions can be resolved in an effective fashion. Indeed, the Trans-Pacific Partnership offers a powerful and pragmatic incentive for accelerating reform and fostering a freer and more open society. U.S.-Vietnam relations today set a powerful and compelling example to the world of what is possible when former adversaries can overcome a difficult history to make peace and work together for the peace and prosperity of their citizens and the world beyond.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.